The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Bob.
Bob.
Bob Maluga Luga. Luga Luga Luga.
Why don't I just call you Bob?
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 26, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. Day 917 of the Biden-Harris administration, 467 days until the 24 presidential election. You can find me on Instagram, the Bob Seska, Twitter, or whatever the hell we're calling it, Bob Seska underscore go. Spoutable is Bob Seska. Threads is the Bob Seska. Are you getting all this? And of course, the Patreon page is bobseskashow.com. Have you seen Oppenheimer yet? Well, whether you have or haven't, the subject of the movie, Robert Oppenheimer's development of the atomic bomb, presents a moral conundrum for all time. So for today's show, we're talking with author and documentarian Greg Mitchell about the questions the movie raises, as well as some background behind the justifications for developing the bomb and its usage at the end of World War II. Don't forget to subscribe to Greg's Substacks, gregmitchell.substack.com. Also, oppenheimer2023.substack.com. Links, of course, in the description at bobseska.com. Meantime, think about supporting this fully independent podcast by subscribing to our Patreon page, bobseskashow.com. Okay, here's me and Greg Mitchell talking about Oppenheimer.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
Well, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by to talk about the big summer blockbuster. So, did you like Barbie?
Have not seen it yet. Have not seen it. I was surprised by some of the reviews of it. And I said, well, maybe this is actually a kind of a smart, interesting movie to see. And I thought maybe younger people love it. Maybe I should see it. But I've heard from some younger people who weren't so crazy about it either, so it makes me more wary.
I've heard that it's pretty good. It's got a good feminist message. It just would have been awkward to have you on just to talk about Barbie.
Yeah, well, I can interject once in a while if you want.
So seriously, though, what did you think of Oppenheimer, the actual summer blockbuster I was referencing?
Yeah, I saw an early screening, and I'd been writing about it for almost 2 weeks now, and I started a new Substack. Adjunct to my regular Substack called Oppenheimer from Hiroshima to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I've been writing daily dispatches of analysis of the film and some, commentary by others and links and so forth. So it's gotten quite a bit of interest, but I went to an early screening, so I've been able to digest it and, write about it a great deal in many different angles, unlike just one shot review. What I found was that, as many people have seen in a lot of the reviews, it's a very powerful movie. It's extremely well directed. It's well written. The acting is great. It's technically great. It's actually surprisingly accurate for a movie of this sort. It's based on a bio of Oppenheimer by two of my friends, Kai Bird and the late Marty Sherwin.
Yeah, that's American Prometheus, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, actually, what's there is quite accurate, surprisingly. And, Nolan says he basically sat down to write the script with the book as his maybe his only guide. Only then did he sell the movie. He's basically went through the book and wrote the movie. And so, terrific. And I also think it has a great ending. I think it's it does focus on the current and future dangers of nuclear weapons. So that's all good. But, as you know, I've been writing about this issue for about 40 years.
Oh, yeah.
And but my focus has been more on the use of the bomb against Japan, the immediate aftermath there, and then mm-hmm. the many years of aftermath in the U.S., the reaction to the use of the bomb to this day, and why it, what the legacy is and what the dangers are today that is caused by the American response to the use of the bomb twice, killing about 160,000 or so civilians, mainly women and children. So, I'm not a typical moviegoer. I come to it not only with a lot of knowledge about what actually happened, but more of a focus on the use of the bomb, not Oppenheimer's life or this great project of, building the bomb at Los Alamos and the test at Trinity and then Oppenheimer grappling afterwards with the hydrogen bomb and then his security clearance, So, I have kind of a special, but I think a very important focus. So, when I saw the movie, although I thought, again, I think everyone should see it. It's very well done by and large. There are some really significant omissions is what my problem is. And we can, start to tick them off if you like.
Yeah. Before we get into that, I want to go back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and maybe that's the part of the omissions you're talking about. But you wrote that the Nolan movie links Oppenheimer more closely to the Trinity test than to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is exactly what Louis Strauss sought to do in real life, right?
Well, the filmmakers, and I guess I could be called a historian of Hollywood and TV examples of covering this this particular episode, but directors and I suppose audiences love the Trinity test. They love to see it. They love to see the build up to it, the drama of it. It's a great success. The scientists celebrate. It's an amazing accomplishment on one level. And no one died that day. Okay.
Yeah.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 160,000 civilians died and more, if you count military people, but, it's a totally different thing. So filmmakers love to focus on Trinity and kind of get past Hiroshima and Nagasaki as easily as they can, which, Nolan kind of follows in that pattern. From all the trailers, from all the promo, it's all about the Trinity test and technical effects and everything else. So in that sense, it's no different. Now, one of the omissions, however, is that, again, unlike other directors, Nolan does not show what happened after the explosion at Trinity while the scientists were celebrating, was that a radioactive cloud drifted over the nearby communities. No one was warned. No one was evacuated.
Yeah.
Fallout fell on them and their livestock and then kept drifting across the state. And there was just a study this week reported in the New York Times a few days ago that found that actually a fallout fell in 46 states after Trinity. But this also set the precedent and set in motion what became decades of U.S. weapons tests, in the atmosphere, all through mainly the 50s into the 60s, where we had this combination of lethality and secrecy, where people did not really know the dangers. I grew up then. I was drinking the fallout in my milk.
Oh, God.
Famously reported.
Yeah.
But the Trinity, again, is kind of all, there was a cover up at the time. And in some ways, the film, films like the Nolan movie, it in a way, continue a cover up in the sense that they don't really mention it. So it can kind of, people would never know just watching the movie. So that's sort of the Trinity link there.
Yeah.
Now, another fact, another thing in the movie is that it never never really shows what happened on the ground in Hiroshima. Again, a rather major oversight.
Mm-hmm.
We see there's a key scene where we see briefly Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer in a screening room watching a screen. And you can tell from a little bit of the narration on the screen that they're showing some footage of from Hiroshima. You're not quite sure what, but at least it's on the ground in Hiroshima. And Oppenheimer turns a little reflective and maybe seems to show some pain in his face watching this. But we never see what's on the screen whatsoever. Hmm. And we don't elsewhere in the movie. On my Substack newsletter today, blog, I show it that in the 1979 PBS series, Oppenheimer, starring Sam Waterston, they had the really almost the exact same scene, same camera angle, and we see Oppenheimer watching the screen. But in that movie, they shift the camera so we can see a little bit what's on the screen, including some of the victims, not too graphic, but at least we see, you know, 45 seconds of what happened on the ground. And Nolan has the same camera angle, but he never focuses it on the screen. So that's a major omission. Another one, just very briefly, they barely mentioned Nagasaki. There's like three references to it almost parenthetically in the last hour, almost like that they threw it. They said, oh, gee, you know, we forgot to mention Nagasaki. We better shoehorn it in.
Yeah, it's like Marianne and the Professor at the end of the Gilligan's Island theme song. Yeah. It's like, yeah, oh, yeah, and the rest. It gets short shrifted by history, doesn't it?
There you go. I'll never get that out of my mind now that you mentioned it.
Sorry.
That's happened before, though. But then another major one is that, and really crucial to me and my work over the decades, is the movie does not really challenge. In fact, it rather sustains the what I call the Hiroshima narrative, or the atomic narrative or official narrative that's held sway with the media and, you know, and many historians and the public since 1945, which is there's a key scene, which is again is quite factual, actually. The interim committee, which was the chief advisory committee for Truman, had this meeting at the end of May, and they sort of briefly discuss, well, how should we use the bomb, or should we use the bomb on people? And that quickly gets shut down, including by Oppenheimer, who takes the lead in dismissing any suggestion of a demonstration of the bomb or telling the Japanese anything or a demonstration shot. Again, it's quite factual. Cillian Murphy is great. And we do see Oppenheimer at different times suggesting regret. But you never quite know what he's sorry about, if he is sorry. It's very muddled. It's more like he's regretful that maybe he helped bring this bomb into the world, which, you know, continues to threaten us, but not specifically about the decision to use the bomb. Mm-hmm. And in fact, real life Oppenheimer, you know, did not offer regret. I mean, right up to the end of his life, 1965, he was still doing interviews where he was defending the use of the bomb. Mm-hmm. So, but if you watch the movie, you know, he kind of has to do all the work of, well, he's regretful about something. Could it be the use of the bomb?
Yeah.
Or whatever. So I think it's a very unfortunate missed opportunity for that official narrative to be challenged, you know, challenged more, and that people would kind of get their minds opened about it.
You know, one of the things I always am curious about, Greg, is, and this is going back to Trinity and the lead up to it, there were so many above ground tests in the Southwest, including some of the tests that contributed to the nuclear milk that you apparently drank. What was the rationale, though, for these tests, given the serious health risks that would occur as a result of all of that radiation? Or did they just not know? Did they not understand the contamination that would take place after all of these tests?
No, they knew about it. They just, number one, they didn't care. Number two, they kept most of it secret.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to test these new generations of bombs. Once the H-bomb came up, they kept getting bigger. You know, well, we this one's giant, and the next one is going to be massive, and the next one's going to be supermassive. And, you know, they set them off in the Pacific to get even underwater. What are the underwater effects? And then in Nevada, in the atmosphere. And you know, again, the problem with not having really any, hardly any mention of radiation in the whole 3-hour movie is so many Americans were affected, more than me. The soldiers who were marched, literally marched under the mushroom cloud in Nevada, the workers in the nuclear industry, the downwinders, of course, who lived downwind from the fallout, again, much more affected than I would have been, you know, a couple thousand miles away, but still. And they even did medical experiments with people using radiation. So, and then, of course, today we have the nuclear waste problem that we're never going to get rid of. So the legacy of Trinity, the legacy of making and using the bomb, goes far beyond just a debate about, well, you know, should we, Truman, have dropped the bomb or not, you know? And so, I mean, I think it's fine that the film has a wider focus, but on the other hand, you would hope it would kind of get closer to the truth on, you know, the whole thing that started this, you know, the actual use of the bomb, not just trying to keep the genie in the bottle.
I'm just perpetually astonished by the sheer number of above ground nuclear tests that took place by the United States on American soil. There's a animation that was going around maybe 10 years ago, and it was a world map, and it clicked through all of the years, starting with Trinity on through modern times. And there was a dot that would show up for whatever nuclear test took place that day. I mean, also including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And
well, by coincidence, Bob, I posted that 5-minute video on my Substack.
Oh, wow.
My Oppenheimer Substack yesterday. And so if you people want to see it, it's like an animation where you see these little pops.
Yeah.
You kind of see these two in Japan, and then a few seconds later you see a few scattered in the Pacific, and then you suddenly see on the mainland of the U.S. pop, 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 pop. It's really kind of shattering when people see it, so I would recommend people find it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's shocking to see all of those dots appear on the world map faster than you can actually process.
They pop like balloons, so it's, you know, it's not just like a static map.
Has there ever been a class action lawsuit with regard to the radiation that Americans were exposed to as a consequence of those above ground tests?
There's been a lot of legal actions. I've kind of lost track with exactly how some of them ended up, but the soldiers were denied benefits and coverage for decades. Some of them finally did win some of that. The downwinders, again, same thing, some victories, a lot of losses. But one of the good things about the movie is that it has sparked, you know, in some quarters, new attention on some of these issues. And actually, the thing that's gotten the most attention is the what happened to the downwinders. And because there have been, they've continued to fight for some sort of compensation or some sort of recognition. And, you know, there's just been a lot of cover. I mean, I'm surprised. Yeah. I've done it myself, but I mean, in mainstream New York Times, Associated Press, and so on and so forth, there's a lot of new coverage of these downwinders out in the Southwest that's happened since the movie came out.
What was Oppenheimer himself exposed to lethal amounts of radiation? I mean, did that actually get him in the end, or some other cause?
Smoking, Bob.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, well, that makes sense. You always see him with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. But I mean, maybe if smoking didn't get him, maybe the radiation would have. Who knows?
He was far away in a bunker at Trinity, and he didn't attend. He was invited to one of the first big Pacific tests at Bikini, which is a famous separate story. Oh, and he refused to go. He didn't. You know, he had seen enough at Trinity, I think.
And I see all these pictures and newsreel footage of soldiers handling. I think it might either be Little Boy or Fat Man. One of them, but they're just pushing it along. They've got their shirts off because it's the Pacific, and they've got their hands on it. And it just seems Good Lord, what happened to those guys? Was there any sort of danger along those lines, or were those early bombs insulated enough that their radiation wasn't an issue?
You know, I don't know about any of those people. There were two, again, I've written a lot about this, two scientists who were exposed in accidents who died. But, you know, this reminds me that, you know, I've written about it. Maybe I was on your show a couple of years ago. My most recent book then called The Beginning or the End.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the title of the first atomic bomb movie from MGM in 1947, which I wrote about. Really a horrid movie of a fantastic kind of fun tale in some ways, how this movie that started as a warning from the scientists about not building more bombs and became pro-bomb propaganda once the Pentagon and Truman and the White House were given basic script approval, and the script was completely revised, and Truman got the actor playing him fired, and it's just a wild story. But the fact is, this problem of Hollywood coming to grips with Hiroshima goes back to 1946 for 1947. So my book tells that full tale. But you know, you mentioned radiation accident. One of the craziest things in the movie is there is a character who is arming the Hiroshima bomb who has an accident just before the takeoff, and he gets a fatal dose of radiation. Now, you might think, wow, they were offering a warning on this that long ago. That's great, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens at the end of the movie is this character who had previously expressed some doubts about the bomb, it ends. He's written a letter to his pregnant wife, which is read to her on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, in which, in this letter written on his deathbed, he suddenly says, "I was wrong, and our future is so bright with nuclear, and you know, it's going to power cars, and you know, the bomb was, you know, had to be done." And as this letter is read, he appears like a ghost on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and finishes reading the letter to his wife. So that may give you some bit of a tone of how Hollywood has treated this issue from the beginning.
Yeah. Oppenheimer called that movie Beginning or the End, he called it bad writing, and said the real characters in it were stiff and idiotic. Right. That's not a resounding endorsement, is it?
Well, yet he signed the release. You know, they had to get him to sign to be depicted in the movie as one of the lead characters and a partial narrator. Had to get his signature on the dotted line, and he finally caved, even though he didn't really change his view of the film. And you know, he saw the script; he knew it had many falsehoods, and yet he went along with it. So you know, it kind of was a typical Oppenheimer moment where he's kind of critical and might have some regrets about something and wringing his hands, but in the end goes along with what's asked of him and, you know, endorsing even in this case, really a false picture of the making and use of the bomb.
In the movie, they depict this guy, Edward Teller, and he's known as the father of the H-bomb.
H-bomb, yeah.
Yeah, and we learned that Oppenheimer ultimately was opposed to the H-bomb. What was his rationale behind taking a posture against the development of the H-bomb? And in other words, what was the differences between the Trinity bomb, for example, and an H-bomb in terms of magnitude of power, things like that, the destructive capabilities of it?
Right.
Is that why Oppenheimer was so opposed?
Yeah, partly. I mean, the H-bomb was hundreds of times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. Yeah. Oppenheimer didn't think, you know, we needed it, that we had enough, that the current bomb was destructive enough. He felt that it would lead to a nuclear arms race with the Soviets. Now, Soviets were already trying to build their own bomb then, but that the Soviets would clearly have to try to match that, which they did. To keep up with us. So each time you ratchet up the destructive force, you inspire, encourage your rival to do the same. So he, you know, and as happened, both sides ended up with tens of thousands of nuclear warheads and could destroy the world thousands of times over.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now there are people who say Oppenheimer was only against the H-bomb because, you know, he was known as the father of the A-bomb, and now there was going to be a bomb that succeeded that. So
bigger
he was
bomb, yeah.
It was his place. I think there's some truth to that, that maybe some of it was almost jealousy.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, if you see the movie, the Teller character, I mean, Teller is someone I've lived with in my mind for decades. And he was always kind of a boogeyman. I mean, here's the man who invented the H-bomb or was the lead guy in the H-bomb. And then in the 60s and 70s, 80s, he was kind of a bellicose figure. You know, really pro-bomb, pro-build more bombs. So Teller became kind of an evil name. But as the film shows, and again, it's mainly true, Teller originally in 1945 was one of those who was sympathetic with, the one organized effort to halt Truman from using the bomb, led by Leo Szilard, a physicist who had helped invent the bomb. Who was based in Chicago, and Szilard started a now famous petition that got hundreds of scientists to sign, asking Truman to hold off. When it got circulated at Los Alamos, first of all, Oppenheimer put a halt to that. But we see in the film Teller two or three times telling Oppenheimer, you know, I might want to sign this petition, or mm-hmm. what do you think about this petition? Oppenheimer keeps shooting it down. And ultimately, as in real life, Teller did not sign it. And actually, Oppenheimer helped bottle it up so it didn't get to Truman until it was too late. So, mm-hmm. which the movie does not focus on. But it does show that Oppenheimer opposing these efforts. But again, these efforts to not use the bomb, giving very, very short attention. But at least the Szilard petition does show up there briefly.
Okay, so today's show is brought to you by the After Party Podcast on our Patreon page. Every Friday, Kimberly Johnson and I get together in the refrigerator for a fourth Bob Seska Show podcast for the week. But this one's different from the usual Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday shows. First of all, it takes place in a refrigerator. Just thought I'd pass that along. The Friday After Party Podcast is loaded with all the politics you want, while also including uncensored, completely obscene conversations about sex, drugs, movies, television, our personal lives, all the crapola we can't get away with on the free shows. So please help support this podcast by subscribing to our Friday After Party for just $10 per month. And bonus, you're also going to get two Shadow Docket shows every week included in that level of support. That's BobSeskaShow.com, or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSeska.com. And we thank you.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Bob Seska!
Why was the magnitude of the A-bomb not good enough? I mean, it's a loaded question, Greg, admittedly, but it seems like the destruction of the original A-bomb, it's like the difference between being a billionaire and a 100 billionaire. It's like, how much money do you really need? How much destruction do you really need to inflict in order to contain the development of the Soviets' proliferation of nuclear weapons? So it seems like it's just vast amounts of overkill to take that next step to the H-bomb, isn't it?
Well, you know, the film communicates, again, accurately, Oppenheimer's view as his defense of making the bomb, mm-hmm. which was always, well, once it became clear that it could be made, you can't stop scientists from working on it, bringing it into the world. Yeah. You know, once it seemed like it could be made in theory, you're going to get people to make something bigger and better. And so that could be extended to the H-bomb as well. You know, recognition. Again, if you're afraid of the Soviets, you say, well, you know, this, we're not going to keep them from building an H-bomb at some point. If we make it, it's going to might inspire them to go faster. And, you know, we should try to control the bomb now. And, you know, in the late 40s, there was a great movement led by scientists and others for international controls of the bomb, for all sorts of things that might slow or prevent an arms race. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, a brief amount of interest in it, and around 1946, 1947, this idea was kind of pushed aside. You know, the Red Scare really took hold. And so most Americans and officials and the media were all in favor of trying to stay ahead of the Russians. And so that was the big motivation. So this opportunity was lost. Now, Oppenheimer was more in favor of that, trying to control the bomb, mm-hmm. More than some others. And in the film, we see part of the reason for him losing his security clearance, the famous hearing, really the last hour of the movie becomes almost a courtroom drama in a way, where the focus on the bomb in a way gets lost a bit. Hmm. Anyway, that's sort of what was happening with the H-bomb. But, you know, that this the MGM movie that I wrote about in my book, and other things that came out to counter people calling for more control of the bomb, including John Hersey's famous Hiroshima article in The New Yorker and book, right? The most important, famous magazine article of all time, and which came out in August of 1946. And mm-hmm. immediately the MGM film was just part of several other important ways that the message of his book, which did focus on the victims and survivors of the bomb, had to be countered, had to be rebuffed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that basically happened, and we are left with decades of an arms race.
I've been curious since I first had you on, Greg, and this was, I think we talked about the beginning or the end back in 2020. And mm-hmm. And we've talked about Atomic Cover-Up, which was your follow-up book and documentary. Where do you personally land on the moral conundrum surrounding the bomb? And I ask that question essentially in two parts. One, the question of the development of the bomb in the first place, which obviously involves Robert Oppenheimer. And then the second moral question, and I get the sense I know where you land on this morally, the actual use of the A-bomb in Japan.
Well, the making of the bomb, was a similar kind of situation where the scientists sort of said, okay, once the atom was split, a bomb can be made. And if a bomb can be made, we better be the ones to make it.
Yeah.
And we hear Hitler has a program. So that was the whole impetus of the bomb project at Los Alamos.
Yeah.
And of course it was led, you know, Oppenheimer was sort of the organizer, the coordinator. He was not the chief inventor. And of course the key people were mainly refugees from Hitler, Jewish refugees.
Yeah.
And they were tremendously motivated, of course, to make the bomb once they got going. And so, you know, that part of it is pretty clear cut. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hitler then surrendered in early May, and we are left with, now Japan's the only target. Japan is every military leader from Eisenhower to MacArthur said, well, they're basically on their last legs. But do we still want to use a bomb? Mm-hmm. And in fact, Oppenheimer was part of the targeting people who met just days after Hitler surrendered to talk about targets in Hiroshima. It was in his office in Los Alamos. So he gets a pass on that more or less in Nolan's movie, although there's one brief reference to it. Mm-hmm. But that became after, starting in May, Japan became the focus. And then you could say, okay, I can accept the fact the bomb had to be made, or the bomb was going to be made. Now the question was, do we use it? Do we have to use it? Do we have a demonstration, or do we not use it at all? And just kind of, you know, keep it in the bottle.
Yeah.
And so that's a whole separate question then. Mm-hmm. And you can judge whether in the end, on August 6th and August 9th, we needed to use the bomb, given the state that Japan was in, given the alternatives. I mean, there were two blatant alternatives besides the demonstration, which was, as we had insisted, the Soviets declared war on Japan. Mm-hmm. Right after Hiroshima, and we, as we had insisted, and you know, Truman himself, a week before that, or 3 weeks before that, wrote in his journal, "Finny Japs," when that occurs. And he had another. He wrote a letter to his wife that had the same sentiment. Even without the bomb, there was the sense among certainly Eisenhower was in this camp that felt that Japan was going to surrender very soon. And there was no need to use this, what Eisenhower called this awful thing, against them. And the other way that in conjunction with that, the way the war could have ended in about the same time period, you know, a little later than the August 6th and August 9th, but could have ended that month, was that we had demanded unconditional surrender from the Japanese, which had become a tradition.
Yeah.
Then, Japan wanted, one of the things they wanted to do is keep their emperor even as a symbolic leader. And we said, no negotiation, not going to give in on that big Japanese demand. And in fact, when Japan surrendered eventually, the U.S. then said, okay, you can keep your emperor, you know, who remains to this day, mm-hmm. keep your emperor. So again, there are many historians who feel that if the U.S., you know, had waited for Russia's entry and had, you know, said in advance to the Japanese, okay, you can keep your emperor, no big deal, that the war could have ended, you know, shortly after the time it did end. And, you know, the problem with the Nolan movie, as many others, you know, it sustains this official narrative that only the bomb or the two bombs prevented this bloody American invasion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no question that an invasion of Japan would have been bloody. I don't care what the casualty figures, you know, that have been bandied about, 100,000 or 500,000 or 10,000 would have been. It would have been bloody and horrible. Okay, but that was not even scheduled till the end of November and December and January. So there were 3 months between the time we used the bomb and when this bloody invasion would have happened. So the question is whether it would have been worth taking a few more days or a couple more weeks or whatever to, you know, throw that out the window and, you know, hold off using the bomb. Because, mm-hmm. You know, Truman, what happened with the Trinity test, you know, I hate to keep babbling on here, but.
No, please keep going.
Okay. One thing that happened with the Trinity test is that once we tested the bomb successfully, Truman knew, as he wrote explicitly in his diary, he had the bomb in his back pocket. Mm-hmm. He could use it, and there'd be several more rolling off the assembly line soon. Once that bomb was successfully tested, to me and to a lot of other people now, all this talk of invasion is moot.
Yeah.
There's no way in a million years that an American president would have launched an invasion of Japan with all the casualties if he had atomic bombs in his pocket. Mm-hmm. So the question that Truman had after Trinity was, you know, do I actually use them now, you know, rush to use them, or do I hold off for a while because I can always use them? In fact, I'll have, you know, five more I could use if I wait another month. But there was no way he was going to, you know, well, let's dither until, you know, November, December, and then we'll, you know, we'll have this invasion. So to me, the invasion is kind of off the charts. Now, that doesn't mean it was irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they had to plan it. Until the bomb was tested, it was going to be a reality, perhaps, if Japan didn't surrender. So, I mean, no one's debunking the fact that invasion was planned and would have been horrid. Question is there any scenario where that invasion would have happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the bomb was tested and like I said, more and bigger bombs were about to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Truman dropped two bombs in early August, and, you know, maybe he would have dropped five bombs in early September. But the legacy of the fact that we dropped the bombs, and I mean, that's, I guess, my final point would be, we can focus too much on should we have dropped the bomb, and, you know, all the Japanese who died, and civilians and everything else. Okay, that's one important legacy, especially for the people who died. But the other question is, okay, what if you accept the fact that, you know, that was certainly a very tempting, inevitable thing that was likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we actually used these two weapons set a horrible precedent for the 78 years since. I mean, again, put aside the civilians who died, okay? Mm-hmm. Just talk about the precedent and the legacy. So using these two weapons, first of all, showed this was a usable weapon. This was a weapon that was worth building more of and having, that you could conceivably use it, even if you say you know don't want to. So that alone helped justify building more and bigger and an arms race. Secondly, it really set the precedent for use, which remains today. U.S. still has a first use or first strike policy, where any president, I know we may be less afraid since Trump is not there for now.
Mm-hmm.
He may be returning. Any president can cite this and use nuclear weapons first in any crisis, or if we are attacked conventionally, conventional attack, we can use nuclear weapons first, because we set this precedent and we've defended it. That's the key thing. I mean, that's what's driven me now for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Is you can't go back and undo it. You can't bring back the dead and so forth. But you can send a different message, where instead of every year, you get historians and the media and officials saying, well, you know, we should never use nuclear weapons again. They're too horrible to use, blah, blah, blah. But in the same breath, defending the two times we did use them. You might call that a first strike.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, it was different circumstances and it was a bloody war and so on and so forth. But everyone can imagine other circumstances, you know, currently where we are threatened or we might suffer casualties or whatever, where it'd say, well, okay, we don't want any nuclear weapons. There's like a taboo, but, you know, maybe we have to use them. And, oh, yeah, we've used them twice before and we've continued to defend it. And, you know, Putin loves to remind us, as he's done this year, every time we raise warnings about don't use nukes in Ukraine. And he loves to say, well, where do you get off saying that? You know, if I want to, you know, you use them and defended it, you know. So, I mean, you know, if I use them, you know, I'll use them. So it's a bad global precedent that, you know, instead of saying, well, you know, yeah, probably in retrospect, a lot of questions about did we have to use them, and we really need to look at that. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't have used them. We should, you know, if anything, Hiroshima and Nagasaki lesson is you have to go the extra mile or miles to try not to use nuclear weapons. Don't you say, well, they're kind of on the assembly line and, you know, we want to get this war over with and, you know, let's use them. And, you know, that's a very, very dangerous lesson for today.
One of the things I keep thinking about, Greg, and maybe you can shed some light on this, and I want to preface by saying I'm not trying to vindicate Truman at all in this decision, but one of the things I think about every time we have this conversation is I fast forward to the Cuban Missile Crisis and how JFK was not necessarily getting the best information from his Joint Chiefs. And right. So then you rewind back to the lead up to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Was Truman at all being snowed a little bit by Curtis LeMay and several others as right. far as invasion versus A-bomb versus casualties versus civilian casualties? Was he being sort of pigeonholed toward authorization to use the A-bomb?
Yeah, I mean, no one pushed him harder than General Groves, who's portrayed by good guy Matt Damon in the movie, with I'd say a fair amount of sympathy. Yeah. Groves was actually kind of an ogre in many levels. Mm-hmm. Was kind of the lead person calling radiation disease after Hiroshima as just propaganda, and even said, "I hear it's kind of a nice, wonderful way to die."
oh my God!
So yes, Groves was pushing him, and there's a famous quote that Groves felt and others observed that Truman was like a little boy on a toboggan, was the expression, that he had come into office suddenly with FDR's death. He was not a major figure in any sort. He was overwhelmed by the job. And right about the time that they're making decisions on pushing this use of the bomb. So it was a terrible situation for him, prepared, but certainly made him susceptible to any kind of, urgings. And in fact, he left himself open and, was happy to have Groves, his Secretary of State, Jimmy Burns, who was the most hawkish on the use of the bomb, kind of make the decisions, and he signed off on them. And, it must be said that in this atmosphere, and I always like to emphasize this, that it's perfectly understandable that people, particularly servicemen and their families, felt that, boy, do anything you can to, get this war over. And the Japanese committed all kinds of war crimes, and, even shortening the war by one day. Yeah. Is a good thing. Look at all the carnage in this war. Zillions of people who died. We'd already carpet bombed Japanese cities.
Yeah,
and of course there was massive carpet bombing of cities in Europe by all sides. Mm-hmm. So it was horrible war crimes. Daily war crimes, and so. You have to be very sympathetic to the view that, let's get this bomb and use it. And I certainly particularly sympathetic to soldiers and their families and now their descendants today who feel and were always told only the bomb prevented this invasion, or, my grandfather could have died in an invasion, or so-and-so. My father was being sent to the Pacific and he would have died on the shores of Japan. So very sympathetic to those the feelings, but it's kind of the view from the foxhole,
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the reality of the necessity of using the bomb was, sustained in the, in Washington and the Pentagon and people who were making the decisions, what they were basing their decision on. So it's made it an incredible historical question and debate now for all these years. New evidence keeps emerging, even like Truman's diary, which I cited early, no one knew about for many years. Mm-hmm. So there's just a different, and people can interpret the evidence different, but always with sympathy for the view that let's get this war over with and, stop the killing if we can. And the view that it seemed like, wow, the war ended or Japan surrendered, 8 days after Hiroshima, seems to be cause and effect. But, yeah. Number one, most people still don't know that, Russia entered the war before that and other things that could have happened and what the people were really saying in Washington about why we wanted to use the bomb and had to use the bomb and so forth. So it's an open question, always with sympathy for what the view has been that it, saved American lives.
I mentioned Curtis LeMay a second ago. He was getting really damn good in the worst ways possible at firebombing Japanese cities made of paper. and just decimating those cities. Why did Hiroshima and Nagasaki bring Japan to its knees when the firebombings did not? And what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to get at here, Greg, is, again, the moral question, was the A-bomb necessary in Japan? Right. We were doing this firebombing and massive civilian casualties, and firebombing is not just, I mean, these are incendiary bombs meant to burn buildings and people. Right. And that wasn't doing it. So maybe, was it the Soviet question? Was it the hypothesis that we dropped the A-bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to send a signal to Moscow? Where do you land on that question of firebombings versus the A-bomb? Why did one work and one not work? And the motivations behind ultimately pulling the trigger on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yeah, well, you know, we'll never, unfortunately, we'll never know
what
would have happened in the course of the war if we had not dropped the two bombs. Mm. Yeah, God help us. Maybe we could have dropped one and then waited on Nagasaki. Yeah. You know, it's one, I mean, to me, there are many historians who, I would say, approve the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb, who are horrified by the Nagasaki bomb and feel it is a war crime. So to me, the second bomb, which just rolled off the assembly line, no one cared enough to intervene and say, well, let's wait. Groves was pushing for the earliest possible use. Nobody cared. You know, it's, oh, yeah, we're going to drop another. We're actually stronger. The plutonium bomb, the second bomb, different than the uranium bomb on Hiroshima, much more powerful. And nobody cared. So to me, Nagasaki is clearly a war crime, and many, many people agree.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll never know what would have happened if Truman had held off. You know, we'll never know. All you can do is speculate. Now, that's very what makes many people comfortable with the use of the bomb was that, we do know what did happen. Japan did surrender in short order. That's a known.
Yeah.
So isn't it tempting to say, well, cause and effect, you know, but we don't know what the alternative, you know, alternative would have been. You know, you're absolutely right. We had been firebombing the cities for quite some time, and Japan, but, you know, yes, Japan had not yet surrendered, but they had sent out peace emissaries and peace feelers. I mean, I think people sometimes overstate that, well, Japan was about ready to surrender, or they had had these surrender the peace feelers, and it's all true. The carpet bombing certainly contributed to Japan seeming to be more willing to surrender. But you can't, you know, you can't just say, well, they had these peace feelers, so they were ready to surrender. But we don't know what would have happened after the Soviet attack, whether that would have happened quickly or not. We don't know. But it was a totally different situation. So, yes, the carpet bombing, more than anything, destroyed Japan's ability to resist, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the industrial strength was decimated, their harbors, the shipping, the planes, you know, they were had to resort to kamikaze attacks. There's no question, as all the military leaders and even Truman said himself, Japan was Oppenheimer said and is quoted in the movie. He says essentially defeated. It's a good essentially defeated.
Yeah,
no one questions that. The question is how quickly they would have actually thrown in the towel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's the question that we'll never have an answer for, and people can watch and make a decision based on historical evidence or maybe on morality. You know, can you defend deliberately dropping two incredibly destructive weapons over the center, deliberately over the center of two cities? No one pretended we were dropping them over a military target. They were deliberately dropped over the center of two cities to cause the most death and destruction.
Yep.
And we had alternatives. We could have dropped them, off in the harbors. We could have dropped them over the military encampments outside the cities. We would have gotten the same visual effect. We could have, done things differently. even in using the bomb, but we deliberately used them over the center of cities. So how do you feel about that morally? Well, look at all the other deaths in World War II, you know?
Yep.
Or you say, look, you can't. I mean, it's, yeah, I cannot defend deliberately targeting hundreds of thousands for death, you know, from the sky. So that's the eternal debate.
It seems like in the long run, general public opinion about the decision to drop the A-bomb has weakened significantly. It seems like through the course of documentaries, certainly your writing and the documentaries that you've made have contributed to this as well. I think people are beginning to rethink support for those two attacks.
Yeah, well, we'll see what the response to the Oppenheimer movie is.
Yeah,
I'm skeptical, but hopeful that people will take not only will they take some message about what we have to do something about curbing nuclear weapons today and getting them off the first strike policy. And it's very vague what the movie wants you to do.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and the movie is also, you know, very vague on what's the lesson of dropping the bombs,
right.
What the message, I don't think it's hard to think that especially younger people coming to this issue the first time are going to rise up over this or say, you know, obviously it was wrong to drop the bomb and we have to dismiss all the media and historians who claim it was justified. I don't see that happening, especially since the movie doesn't do a good job of reopening that question. But, you know, I hope there are positive after effects of the movie. You know, I guess we'll see soon.
Yeah.
If that's true, it's certainly massively popular. But what people come away with, they may come away more with, wow, what a great performance by Robert Downey. So glad he's back. He's back. And you know, Cillian Murphy's been underrated for so long.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's great. This is his star turn. You know, and now, let's see, when can we go see Barbie? you know, I just don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I hope that there's a positive after effects of the movie being made and so many people seeing it.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed there's a love story in Oppenheimer. And the first thing I thought of when I heard that news was, well, it's just like the beginning or the end.
Yeah, well, there's two. In Oppenheimer, as some people have read in reviews, basically he did in real life have a mistress named Jean Tadlock, who was a communist or a former communist.
Yeah.
And he famously left Los Alamos while building the bomb to sneak off to San Francisco to see her. Mm. And she later committed suicide in a bathtub. But you know, the film has, you know, film has really a couple of ludicrous sex scenes. I have to say, we see, not only do we get a chance to see Gene Tadlock, nude, riding Oppenheimer, but Oppenheimer, his famous quote about, I am become death, destroyer of worlds. She kind of shows that quote to him in a book and he kind of reads it off while having sex, in that scene.
Okay.
Then there's another scene where he imagined he's in his security hearing and he's somehow in this room with all these old white men and his wife. He has this vision of having sex with his mistress on the table. So I don't know if that's a spoiler alert or we'll warn you off the movie, but
maybe it's necessary to break the tension. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, I did want to mention that we didn't come back to it in a way, just, you know, you mentioned my film and book of the same name, Atomic Cover-Up.
Yes.
Which, you know, I would encourage people to seek out, especially, I mean, the book is readily available because it's what happened at the other end of the bomb, which is not in the movie, in Japan. And then the same theme we've been talking about, how that was covered up, how the U.S., suppressed all of the Japanese and the key American footage for decades after. So Americans were denied a chance to see really the most vital historic evidence of what happened in Japan for decades. So, you know, my book and movie, again, we get away from Hollywood and look at the real world. where decisions were made to, you know, to suppress the, you know, the, really the most important evidence of what had happened at the other end of the bomb. And I think that's, again, certainly what's missing in Oppenheimer.
Well, okay, my friend, you started a new Substack, didn't you, covering some of this stuff, right?
Yeah, and I want to, it's called Oppenheimer from Hiroshima to Hollywood. And I know, yeah. I mean, I have another Substack that's called Between Rock and a Hard Place that goes back to some of my rock and roll days with Crawdaddy and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a separate Substack. So if people are looking, want to find the daily Oppenheimer Substack, you'd have to search, Oppenheimer from Hiroshima to Hollywood, and you'll find it.
Well, I've got links in the description under this episode. Meantime, the book is called The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. That, of course, is available everywhere still. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is there any place conveniently showing the documentary based on that? Is that still available out there somewhere?
Atomic Cover Up, if that's what you're referring to, is not online anymore.
It was
shown at 20 film festivals, and it was up online for free for a long time. And now there's actually a distributor who's getting it to schools and universities and
oh, great.
Community groups. So it's getting wide play out there, but it's no longer easy to find online in its full form.
Is it ever going to be available like on physical media or something?
Oh, sure.
Like a Blu-ray?
Yeah. I'm sure it will be. Yeah, I'm sure it will be.
Okay, sounds good.
I've done two films in the last year that ended up on PBS, and so we're still hopeful about this film actually getting the national PBS airing.
Yeah, see, I blanked on that. I thought there was a documentary also based on The Beginning or the End.
No.
But, okay, well, that's just the book.
Just me right. Yapping about it everywhere. So. But I think the film may be up on YouTube besides streaming.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Someone told me they saw it in its entirety on YouTube, but I don't know if that's true.
Okay, my friend. Well, this is awesome as always. Yeah, yeah.
Always a pleasure, Bob. Any time. We could have me on sometime. We'll talk about music or baseball or something.
Perfect. You're on. We'll do it.
Okay. Thanks,
okay,
Bob.
Take care. See you next time, Greg. Bye-bye.
Let's fall into each other. The light is fading fast. The days of you, so let us do each one like it's the last. The stream will be a river before the claws of dread grab my heart and make it smart with things I should have said. You never hear it coming, it's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a slow apocalypse. Strolling through the suburbs, keep a weather eye. Bayonets and fighter jets will pierce the pregnant sky. Refrigerated houses with all the curtains drawn. Tumbleweeds are gaining speed on picture-perfect lawns. You never hear it coming, it's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a slow apocalypse. Mind the things we ought to say. You never hear it coming, it's it's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a soul.